I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Gentlemen, please welcome on the stage Paul, Steve Hanley, and Kevin Cummins. Round of applause.
Right,
good afternoon.
Yeah. Welcome to the Old Brother podcast, which we don't normally do live. But we're delighted to be here today.
Before, yeah.
Oh, it's loud in the words.
Are we allowed to do this, are we?
I think we're still, we're going to make the best of it, but for the next hour we're still allowed to talk about the fall. I'm not sure when the call...
No.
You're not allowed to make... You have to put that...
Right, I think it's because it's a Sunday, we're all right.
Oh, of course, yeah. So I was going to introduce this gentleman here, but obviously I don't need to introduce him to you because you've all bought a ticket, so it'd be a bit weird if you didn't know who he was, wouldn't it?
But for the purpose... Someone asked me directions to here outside the bus station. He didn't know who I was.
That's the being behind the camera.
That's sent him the wrong way.
Well, for the purposes of the tape, our guest today is the marvellous Mr. Kevin Cummins. By way of introduction, if you've ever seen a picture of Joy Division, it was probably taken by Kevin, I think. So if you weren't lucky enough to be going to gigs in Manchester in 1979, and you've got an image of Joy Division, then Kevin probably took the picture. I think that's fair to say, don't you?
Fair to say.
Yeah, I think so. But
I'm taking pictures of other people.
Oh yeah, we're going to get on to one of them in a moment. Then. So the reason he's on the Old Brother podcast, the Old Fall podcast, the Old Fall Brother cast, is because of this marvellous tomb we have in front of us, which is a collection of his works over the years, taking pictures of the fall. And one of the joys of this book is, unfortunately, with Joy Division, it's quite a short period. This is quite a journey, this one, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, actually. I mean, you kind of see 40 years of Mark running through it. And really, it's kind of my story alongside theirs and his and yours and whoever else was there, plenty of you. But somebody reviewed it on Amazon and said, it's all right, this book, but it's got a lot of gaps in it. And it's like, well, I didn't live with him.
There's not that many gaps, to be fair.
I wouldn't be alive if I did this, don't I? No, there aren't. I mean, it's just whenever I dig in and out of his life,
He does know how taking photographs of bands work.
No, I do. You get slagged off usually on Amazon for the packaging being awful. One star.
Shit, mate.
The packaging fell apart.
Right, we're going to go back. That's a bold lyric, if in case you weren't there. So, one of the cliches that gets trotted out, probably by me as much as anybody else, is that Manchester Music started at that Sex Pistols gig in 1976. But you were taking... I mean, I don't know how much you were actually earning, but you were taking professional photography way before that, weren't you?
Well, I graduated that year. So whenever I took any pictures of a band, if I started working for the NME probably May, June 77.
Right.
You know, kind of bombarded them with information. False and true. Mainly false, actually. You know, and whenever I did a job for the NME, it'd be probably cost me £20 in film and processing and a couple of prints. I got £6.50 for it. So I wasn't sure it was going to be something I'd do for a long time. I thought maybe I'd do it till I got a proper job.
Yeah, it was expensive business then, wasn't it? I'm thinking of that picture. Like, there's a picture of you. You took a David Bowie, and that was 73.
Yeah, I did that at my art school, mainly so I could blag it into a gig, to be honest.
Well, like, that's how you make your money,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I got him free. Yeah, I didn't have to pay to go to most gigs, so that was okay.
Yeah.
But the Bowie one I took when I was 19, and because I was obsessed with Bowie.
Yeah.
And I just thought, walking with a college camera case and they'll just let me in, and they didn't really have backstage passes or anything then, so I just used to, sometimes I'd take the case to a gig so I could stand on it really. and then after going to about three gigs I thought, it's quite good, I'll put a camera in it and maybe take some pictures next time. So I took some of Bowie.
Where was that? What venue was that?
Free Trade Hall. Well, I went to the Hard Rock in 72 at Christmas.
I just missed that.
Yeah, which was great. And I took three photographs there because I was trying out a colour film. We were given some project over Christmas to do. So I took some pictures of Bowie on this really grainy kind of fashion colour film. GAF 500 for all you interested folk out there. And you had to send it off to Germany. It took about 3 weeks to come back, and then it was shit. And we did loads of different things on it just to try it out under different conditions. So I took three pictures of Bowie, which are kind of okay. And then I took some pictures of Bowie Free Trade Hall, and then we went to Leeds as well, that Ziggy Stardust, the lad in same tour.
Wow.
And took some there. And that's when, and the V&A bought a picture from me.
Right.
And so it was like my first sale ever to a gallery, and I thought, you know, maybe it is quite a good way to do it. When I say they bought it off me, they said, would you like to donate it?
Right, yeah. Well,
sounds better if you say,
bought
it from me.
I don't wish to cast aspersions on whoever was teaching your college, but that photograph is as good a photograph as you've ever got. So I don't think, you can't have had much to learn, because that's a fantastic one.
You still learn. I mean, that's not being, you know, false modest or anything. I think you learn all the time by looking at other work and looking how you can make a better picture. And I took a picture at the Free Trade Hall of Bowie, and I thought I wasn't in the quite right position for the shot I wanted. So when I went to Leeds, I stood in that position and waited for that moment where he does the mime to width of a circle, and I got the shot I wanted.
Yeah.
And you kind of have to do that. You have to research your subject a little bit, maybe.
Yeah.
Can't just wing it all the time. a lot of the time. You know.
So what research did you do for the fall?
Well, I'd been to the gig, so I knew exactly where I wanted to stand to get a better picture.
Okay.
So then I just stood there at the Leeds show, which was only half full, actually, because it had been cancelled from earlier in the tour. They were due to play Leeds University, and the stage was too small, so they played this venue, Leeds Roll Arena, which didn't really have gigs, and it didn't sell out. So we were able to just wander about, and I stood in exactly the spot I thought might make the picture better, and took it.
So when was the first time you took the fall then? Was that
probably that gig at St George's youth club in Collyhurst. They played it, we put the ticket up actually, and it was 50 pence. Nobody bought one, so they changed it to 20 pence, hastily crossed out and written 20 pence in biro. And after about three songs, it was a youth club, and the guy who ran the youth club came over to him and said, it's not quite what we were expecting. Kind of the story of Mark's life, to be fair. And he said, you're a bit loud, and it's not really the right kind of music. So he told them to pack up, really. And whoever was managing or looking after him rang the squat, not the squat,
the ranch,
yeah, and said, can we finish our gig there? So they said, yeah, come down. And so they went down to this place about a mile away, which was a punk club, really, but rarely had, I mean, it had bands on, but it was like, it wasn't even like a tenth of the size of this. It was quite a small place. And Mark being Mark didn't play the first three numbers again. He just carried on the gig as though it was a break in proceedings. He wasn't giving them extra for their 20 pence.
I mean, that picture from the ranch is quite... It's quite unusual because it's everybody, isn't it? That's,
yeah.
It's in the book, obviously.
Yeah, I had a very wide-angle lens that I like to use. And so you could... I was probably about 18 inches, 2 feet away from them, but it was very wide, so I managed to get a whole band shot.
It's a brilliant photograph.
Yeah, actually. You kind of get the feel for the excitement of being there, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Although I did a wider shot, and you can see the audience, they're not remotely excited. I was.
But, they were a good-looking bunch of them, weren't they? Well, they were, maybe not in the classical sort of sense, but it was a good-looking band.
Yeah,
they?
I thought so. They were a very strong-looking band, definitely. Yeah, yeah. And he didn't want to be anything, you know. That was like the first shot at the Colliehurst thing.
Right.
Mark with his Rock Against Racism badge.
Yeah, yeah, of course. Yeah, quite right.
Every so time.
The, when you say the Colliehurst, that's the youth club.
That's the youth club, right. Gig, yeah, and then these are the ranch. These are the ranch
bands. That's brilliant, that. I mean, that, you know. They look like a proper rock band there, don't they?
They do. Yeah. It was like the third gig. It was the third gig. Well, it was like either the second and third gig or third and fourth, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Although he'd count it as one, I think.
Yes. Yeah.
Same
gig.
Yeah.
But they weren't quite... They didn't look quite so glamorous, the next show, which was in the flat.
Oh, yeah. Well, we did the shoot when... for Sounds, I think it was, or maybe Anime, I can't remember, but around Christmas. And Mark, I never wanted to shoot traditional rock and roll pictures particularly, and Mark certainly didn't. And at the time, Man City were running this series of features in the programme of players at home with their lovely wives and lovely children and lovely house and lovely car and all this. And Mark said, why don't we do it like that? And I said, well, you know, Dennis Stewart's leafy mansion in Cheshire, it's a bit like different to your flat in Prestwich. And he said, yeah, but it'd be fun. And of course, you know, you present a magazine with a picture like that with no idea.
It don't look fun, to be fair.
No, it wasn't. No, and he made some attempt at tidying up by shoving about a week's washing up under the sofa. And there was a few political posters on the wall and various bits and pieces. And I said, shall we do a picture outside as well? So we did the picture by Prestwich Hospital. And it was only when I was processing the pictures that I realised Mark was holding a cat. I had no idea where he got it from. I didn't even know if it was his.
Oh, right. Did he bring it with him?
No idea. So, but it was dark, you know, and I was having to do this shoot with Flash outside about 8 o'clock at night. And, like I say, when I processed the pictures, I thought, oh, God, he's got a cat, you know.
Well, it's interesting that because... That you've talked about it before in the context of Joy Division about your photographs kind of shape the image of the band. I think that's really true, John. Mm. I mean, if you've ever met any of Joy Division, they certainly weren't the here are the young men, dour kind of guys.
They weren't at all, no, and everybody, that was how we wanted them to appear, and that was how Tony Wilson wanted them to look like, Rob wanted them to look like, and they were really intimidating. And Rob said the reason he never wanted them to do interviews is because they were all really stupid. And they'll just say fucking stupid things, you know. So he said, it's better to be enigmatic.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, so I never took a picture of them smiling. I didn't do anything like that. Everything was really kind of Eastern European serious. In fact, one of the pictures from the bridge, looking back into Manchester, when I've done interviews in Europe, people say, is that Dresden or is it Poznan? And then I said, no, it's actually Manchester. Yeah. That's what it was like.
Yeah.
And they're kind of horrified because they have this idea that England's great.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was a good place, Manchester, then, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, yeah. I mean, you know, that Hollyhurst Youth Club was quite near the Electric Circus, which was a big punk venue. And I used to drive there because I bought my camera gear, and it was a bit dangerous.
Yeah, yeah.
And we'd meet up in the ranch after a gig, and half the people who'd been at the gig were like ripped clothes, black eyes,
caught everything.
It was like a mile back in sand. Yeah, people, they used to get ambushed all the time, and I'd be just driving around, not having a clue that any of this was going on.
You had to walk from town, didn't you?
I only went to the Electric Circus once.
Yeah, but it was.
Yeah, it was, yeah, definitely. Yeah. And there was a lot of kids there threatening to mind your car.
Oh, yeah. It's a bit of a poor show. We talk about Manchester and how central music was. It was a bit poor show that the Premier Punk venue was a mile outside the city centre in Collyhurst. Well, it's a bit grim.
Yeah, it was.
I mean, it wasn't because it was such a nice place either. The venue was a shithole by
Not completely. I mean, you wouldn't get away with it now, would you?
No.
Nowhere like that would be allowed to open.
No, I always thought that about. There was a few, weren't there? The Mayflower.
They were all like that.
That was 100 years late being condemned, that.
Yeah.
The Mayflower.
Yeah.
I mean, terrible. But
most venues in Manchester were like that.
Yeah, yeah.
They were terrible.
I mean, speaking of terrible places, you famously took pictures of Joy Division and The Fall in T.J. Davidson's.
Yeah.
Now, that made the circus look like Bloody Ritz, didn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, that
the
was...
The Ritz Hotel, actually. Not the Ritz Ball.
Not the Ritz venue, no.
Which was just as bad as the others. When you look at the Joy Division pictures of them in the rehearsal room, you'll see a lot of Coke cans and Fanta cans around, and they're all full of piss, because none of them could be bothered going to the floor below to use the toilets, which were usually blocked anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
And the bloke who owned it, Tony Davidson, had no interest in ever getting them repaired.
Well, if he was writing a list of repairs for that building, I think the toilets would be fair. Making sure the floors weren't condemned.
Yeah,
well.
The whole thing.
I mean,
terrible.
Not to say how bad it was, the caretaker was a tramp he found sleeping there.
That's true. There's another picture I took of them, and underneath the light fitting, there's a Mac Fisheries plastic bag hanging from the ceiling, and it was to catch the water before it hit the electric light.
Yeah, yeah. Not that there was much electrical equipment in there.
That was an amazing repair for that place, wasn't it?
No, it's good.
But I mean, they are amazing, those photographs. The ones of the fall and the ones of Joy. It's a great room to take a photograph in.
It was great. It's interesting how different the bands look. I also photographed a band in there called Alien Tint, if anyone remembers them. But I've never really... Those pictures haven't really flown out.
When's that book coming out?
Yeah.
The
thinner volume.
When I've exhausted all of the rest of it, I might do a Tony Davidson, TJ Davidson's book.
Yeah, you'll have to pay him.
Yeah, I know. He did a book, didn't he, last year or the year before?
He did, yeah.
Yeah.
Have you read it?
No, he sent me a copy. He said, I've used your picture on the cover. And I said, oh, great. You're going to send me some money? And he said, it's a picture of me. I don't have to pay, do I?
That's how it works. Yeah. So you settled out of court?
He's kind of connected, though, isn't he?
Well, you'd like to think so.
Yeah, him and Ray Rossi and Mike Rossi from Slaughter and the Dogs. Well, they're all kind of...
He must be getting on a bit now, then. He
looks well. Have you seen a picture of him? He looks about 35. I don't know what he's... I don't know if he's had his blood
drop
to you or something, but...
Yeah, the picture of him was a picture of him sitting on a Lotus Elite in Manchester. I was never sure whether it was his or not.
Probably not.
Yeah.
So, I was going to ask you, and you've said it again about Joy Division, about you felt the responsibility to present them in the best way. Did you feel the same about The Fall, or were they kind of more...
I don't think I was ever allowed to impose my will on The Fall, to be honest. Photographing The Fall was always very different because... Mark actually did like having his photograph taken.
He was really good at it as well.
Yeah, he did like it, but he didn't like to do it straight away. So whenever you'd go and meet up to do a session, it was like every time I photographed the fall, it pretty much would be a different lineup. And I always said it was a bit like going around to see your friend's house and he's got a new wife and kids. And there was, he had absolutely, he never introduced them to you. You have absolutely no idea who these people
That'd be true, yeah.
And then I didn't even to the band, you know, someone else would just be there. And he would, he'd sometimes bring one member out for a photo session, sometimes just turn up on his own. He always knew whether we needed just him or the band, but it didn't matter. And then he'd say, oh, let's go and have a pint and have a chat about Man City, all this, that, and what have you been doing? Take piss for half an hour. 5 pints later, it's too late to do pictures, so you have to go back the next day. And that was pretty much the story of the fall every time I photographed him. You know, he wouldn't tell me where the venue was, he wouldn't be there. If he did tell me, it'd be like, you'd always try and have to work it out that you'd go to the nearest pub close to where he told you to meet up, and Odd-on he was there.
Didn't you do that abroad a few times with you?
Yeah, he did, yeah.
Where was that then?
Berlin. Although, to be fair, he kind of fell out with the band on the way there as well, didn't he? So,
okay.
We were going to Berlin and they were playing a gig there, and I always wanted to photograph him in Berlin, and I flew there direct. And they didn't turn up for ages. And then, this is like 2006, 2007, and I bumped into Steve Trafford that afternoon, and I said, what's happening? Are you going down to the vet? And he said, oh, don't even ask. He said, it's a fucking nightmare. He said, first of all, Mark tried to smoke on the plane, and he got told that you haven't been allowed to smoke on a plane for 10 years, but that he didn't seem to notice that.
What he used to say was, what are they going to do? Throw me off?
Don't Mark arrest you when you actually land.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then he said he got to Frankfurt and airport to change flights, so he wanted to smoke there and they wouldn't let him smoke there. Then when he finally landed and got in a cab, he lit up and the taxi driver said, no smoking in my cab. And he said, I fucking smoke where I like. And he said, not in my cab. And he turned round and grabbed the cigarette out of Mark's mouth. So Mark punched him. And all this happened at the traffic light, and coincidentally there was a news team at the traffic lights making a news story, so there's a camera presenter and they're just looking at his cab rocking behind. And so they turned the camera on it and filmed it all, and then said to the cab driver, if you need that, we've got it, you know, we kind of saw him assault you. And so the tour manager had to give him some money to shut up. He got to the hotel, took his false teeth out and slammed them on the bedside table, where he bounced off, and while he's looking for him, he stood on them. And then he said, just another day. Then he said to Eleni, you're going to have to go out and get these fixed because you speak German.
Apart from that, how was the gig? Didn't go that far.
The gig was great, and then he wouldn't do any he would only do pitched across the road from the gig. So it was like, we'd come all the way to Berlin, and you want to pitch, it looks like we took it on Salford Precinct. And that was it, but like you say, that was a fairly typical day.
Yeah, but I mean, the thing about all that is, you end up with great shots at the end of it, don't you?
You do, yeah.
Because they're like, oh, that's all right, then.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's all I'm there for. I'm not family counsellor, am I?
Why isn't Charlie signed? Because for all that, and for all it looked like he was mucking you about and all that, he was quite invested in the mythology of the photographs.
Yeah, of course he was. He understood what pictures would do for them. There are some bands who don't understand it at all, and some, you know, like the Fall did, Manic Street Preachers did, you know, they always really understood how strong the rock press was and what it would do for them, and how you had to work at, you know, you didn't just turn up and say, well, what's your idea? For their first NME cover that I did, They went out the night before and asked girls in a nightclub to give them love bites so they'd look really trashy the following day.
This is a Manic Street Preachers, not the Fall.
It's clear, that's not the Fall. Yeah. So they were, so they all had these bruises on their necks and looked dead trashy. It was great. That's what you want. You want a band to understand how you helped to build rock and roll mythology. And I think it's harder now because a lot of bands take their own pictures.
Yeah.
They take too many pictures. They take pictures in the dressing room, take pictures going on stage, they take pictures of their breakfast. So there's no mystique. With musicians, you want mystique. When you're a kid, I didn't want a picture. I didn't want to know what David Bowie had for breakfast. I like to think he lived in a spaceship and ate moon dust.
Yeah.
Well, he probably did, to be fair.
Yeah, probably.
As far as I know, he did. But you don't want all that information.
Yeah.
You want mythology.
Yeah.
And I don't think the only band I think in the last 20 years who've understood that are the White Stripes. Jack White really understood how to manipulate his own image, and I think very few bands understand that now.
Well, I'm not so sure Joy Division didn't do it. You talked at all.
No, they didn't. No, I mean, the first thing I said to them was, what do you want to do for a picture? And they said, stand at a bus stop. I said, but that isn't actually going to make a great enemy cover. He said, but that's what we do. Great.
The quote I like to hear about George is that I didn't want to take a picture of Ian Curtis having a piss in a bin.
Well, exactly. Yeah. I mean, you don't want to spoil mythology, do you? And I think the fact that there are so few pictures of them helped to build that mythology enormously.
Massively, yeah.
Yeah.
They were quite clever at that. That was Rob's doing, was it? Yeah.
A little bit. Well, it was Rob really stopping and being interviewed. And then I remember the first time after Ian died and we became New Order, I did a piece with New Order for The Face with Paul Rambali, the writer. And Paul said to me, can you meet me at the station? I don't want to go and meet them first because I'm terrified of them.
Yeah.
And I thought, that's hilarious. How can anyone be terrified of Bernard? Even Hookie's not terrified of him. But
No. Hey, they're doing the Rock and Roll. They've been nominated for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. That'd be an interesting backstage conversation.
They're tenth though on the list at the moment.
Are they?
So I don't think they're going to make it.
You've got to pay as well, haven't you? You've got to pay to go.
Yeah.
I can't see Bernard stumping up.
No, not at all. Definitely not.
How much?
Yeah. I can't remember what it is. It's not cheap.
It'd take too long for them to work that one out.
Yeah. But getting back to talk about the Fall. The way you talk about Mark and taking photographs of Mark, he was similar in interviews as well, wasn't he? I mean, he'd piss the interviewer about, but you'd always end up with a good bit of writing at the end of it.
Yeah, I remember. I mean, Ted Kessler wrote a brilliant piece in his book about meeting Mark for the first time. And he said, first thing Mark said to him was, are you a Jew or a Nazi?
Was it an
air? Yeah. And it's like, oh my God, so that was his intro to Mark.
Yeah, yeah. He'd have been in trouble if he wasn't Jewish, though, wouldn't he?
Yeah.
How would you answer that? Is it either or?
I know.
That was probably where the name came
from. And then he met him about 10 years later, and he said, I've met you before, haven't I? He said, I can't remember if you're a Jew or a Nazi.
And it was all downhill from there.
He's got a bit more going for him than that, mate.
Yeah. So, you took pictures of Rafters with me and when me and Steve were there, and that was a great place to photograph, wasn't it?
Rafters was great because it was very low stage, wasn't it? And
very low ceiling.
Weirdly, there was such a huge photograph of James Cagney on the back wall behind the stage. Bands quite often put a black cloth. I think I've still got a picture of maybe Generation X with James Cagney leering.
Oh, brilliant! Fantastic.
So, but it was a good venue.
There was a number of sort of iconic places in Manchester. Yeah. Again, the thread running through that they were all a bit of a dump, weren't they? I think.
Yeah, Rafters was okay though. Rafters was down. There was a nightclub in Manchester called Fagin's, which was like a proper cabaret club, and Rafters was downstairs. It was like the diffusion part of Fagin's, really.
Yeah.
So you know, it was the cheaper end of the market.
It was, definitely.
But it was good. I always thought it was quite a good gig, that.
Yeah.
Rafters was quite good, but you had to wear a suit and tie to get in.
It depends.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I only ever went there once, that was to see Scott Walker.
Wow.
Which, you know, when I was, like, I went when I was about 19, I looked about 13 when I was 19, and I had this ill-fitting suit on, but I managed to get in and see Scott Walker.
Did you take a picture of him?
No, no. I just went to see him, and he knew the owner, and he did a gig nearly every year at Rafters. Just
Cheerful young man, Scott Walker, I believe.
And it was great. So, you know, that was great. But Rafters itself was, it's a good punk venue and stuff was on there.
Yeah.
I mean, at one stage in like 1976, 77, there were gigs two or three times a week. Go to Rafters, Electric Circus, and if you could afford it, you could go to Liverpool. Eric's would have the same gig on Saturday that we had Sunday.
Yeah.
So, you know.
So,
go on.
I was going to say, you did the cover for I'm Curious Orange, didn't you? What's the album called? I can't remember some of the playing.
It's called I'm Curious Orange, but there's a different spelling for the album and for the show for some unknown reason.
That's the only time you did the album cover. Well, you didn't set out to do the album cover.
No, I didn't. No, I photographed him. I was doing I'm Curious Orange for the NME. And he didn't tell me where to meet him, and nobody met me, and I had to just get, I've been in San Francisco, and I had to get back from there to Edinburgh, and I was supposed to be met at Heathrow, no one met me there, I just had to pay for myself to get up to Edinburgh. I got there, I had no idea where they were rehearsing, whether it was on stage, what I was supposed to do. I had to go in a pub and find a leaflet for the festival and find out where they were, and I got there and he said, oh, you fucking found us then.
You're late.
And we did all the pictures on stage and set stuff up with him and Michael Clark, and they ran through the show and so on. And after we did the setup shots, Mark said, so can I have one of those for the album sleeve? And I said, why would I give you a picture for the album sleeve when we... I said, if you wanted that, why didn't we just do some extra ones? And he said, because you'd have charged us. He said, you can just give us a spare one. I said, it don't work like that. I said, if I give you one, you're going to have to pay for it anyway.
Yeah.
He said, what the fuck for? He said, you've just taken them. eventually the record company, you know, I just loved it. The record company did it, and they sorted it out with me. And then when he did that 50,000 full fans can't be wrong, he just did that cutout of the cover. And I said to him, and he did it on mugs and badges, did the lot, and I said, did you license that? Because my stuff's licensed through Getty. And he said, no, he said, I just cut it off the picture you gave me. Absolutely no idea that you should pay for it because it was a picture of him.
Oh, he probably had an idea, which he chose to ignore.
Well, I'm being kind. And then when we did these pictures in like 2005, 6 and around then, they were on Sanctuary, and Sanctuary paid for them, and Sanctuary licensed the use for a year. And I said, but you'll want them for longer than that. And he said, well, if we do, we'll renegotiate. And of course, a year and a day after, the day after the license runs out, Mark starts using the pictures, you know, so they've got to pay again for them. And he just kind of did it willfully, didn't he?
Oh, that kind of thing, always.
And I just said to him, you know, Mark will do this. This is what he always does. So why don't you just license him for 10 years and then you don't have to worry about it?
Where's the problem in that?
No, so, exactly. So it's just to wind you up constantly.
Because I was going to ask about that shot. That shot behind what's now the Greater Manchester. What's it called these days? The Exhibition Centre.
GMEX.
It's not been called the GMEX for 15 years. I can't remember what it's called.
Central Station.
Yeah, it was a central station originally, because it was kind of abandoned when you
took it. Yeah, it was, yeah.
Because that's I mean, there's no coincidence that that's the colour. That's an amazing shot, that, isn't it?
Well, I like the cobbles and echoing the similar pattern on his jersey.
Yeah.
Not many people can get away with wearing a golf jersey.
Well, to be fair, a lot of people had them. They used to sell them on Grey Mare Lane Market. Yeah. They were like kind of nylon, weren't they?
They were very nylon.
Yeah, they were. Yeah. But that's part of the thing about the Ford. You could... It's like you went willfully to look completely untrendy and ends up looking quite iconic, which is it's quite a trick.
Really. Well, a friend of mine works for Alexander McQueen, and she said to me, we've got your fall book on our style shelf. So if Alexander McQueen do Jacquard golf jumpers next year, you know where it's starting.
he's rocking a great pair of brothel creepers on that picture.
Yeah. Not Mike Lee,
sir. Were they?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Mike Lee was a drummer before me. And he famously joined the band from a Teddy Boy revival, but you know, so what we got, Rockin' Ricky and the Red Stripe
and the Velvet Collars.
Well, Rockin' Ricky and the Velvet Collars, yeah. But he brought this like chest of dressing up clothes, basically.
That's quite good.
Yeah. So I saw them the first time they played.
Well, you were there as
well, obviously. But they played Bolden Vale, which was in obviously Bolden, south of Manchester, and he had his dressing up box. So they came out and they had Mark had them brothel creepers on, and Martin had this beautiful taupe, you know, them shawty waddy jacket. Beautiful it was. He looked very well in it, didn't he?
Yeah.
And the other black cap on, but I don't think it lasted long. Mike's dressing up box.
He probably took it with him when he was booted out.
He left. Yeah, they weren't playing. They only did 109 gigs in the 8 months he was in there. You never took them.
No.
He was great, Mike.
He'd left before I even knew he'd started.
He was the least likely looking fall member. He looked like an off-duty policeman.
Yeah.
Which seemed to be a favourite, the fall, didn't he? Not that much, man. So, did you prefer to take the fall in black and white or colour? Because they look great in black and white, but then when you see like the Curious Orange and then later ones of Mark. Well, I didn't need to talk about that shoe, that sort of last one you did, but
yeah.
They did do well. They look really good in colour as well, don't they?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you don't have a riot of colour, but I always felt the colour work for them. I mean, you know, Mark, it was quite difficult sometimes with Mark because he did have quite a lot of spots and cold sores and various scabs on his face. So it was, it was a bit.
They're better in black and white.
They're better in black and white. Smooth that out. In colour, it's there for all to see, I'm afraid. There's photographer Bruce Guild, an American photographer, who goes in very, very close on face and does 60 by 40 prints of them, and I'd always thought it'd be quite good to get him to photograph Mark.
Yeah.
But probably scare people away. It's quite a, he's, you know, it's a real, he uses a kind of special light and film to bring all the flaws out of your face, so I think might have been too much.
Because that picture you did, I don't think it's the whole band, is it? Is it just Mark and Elaine at the end?
Yeah.
And he's, they're astonishing pictures, though. So, I mean, by then he wasn't a young rock star or anything, but they're quite sort of, sad in a way.
I think so. He kind of, again, he turned up really late, and I'd been in Manchester all day waiting for him, and he turned up about 7:15, so I had about half an hour before the last train from Manchester back to London, so we had to do it fairly quickly, and I'd found this wall of, it's a carpet, those pictures against the grey and bluey wall, it's a car park wall in Salford, behind Salford Town Hall, and he just started throwing his head around and kind of like the fire.
Yeah.
But he was moving a lot, you know, and it was quite interesting. And also because the light was dropping, there's a slight blur on some of them, which is really nice.
Yeah.
But his face was really falling apart then. I think because of the kind of almost canvassy background for the shots, he ends up looking like a Francis Bacon painting or something. It's they were quite difficult to work with at first, those pictures, because he does look very striking on them.
But
I think magazines found them difficult to use.
Right.
So, but I thought it looked great.
It's a mark of him, really, if you pardon the pun, that he wasn't well.
No.
We can argue about whether the fall was Mark or Mark was the fall, but his life was in the fall, wasn't it? So if he didn't look well, then he wasn't like, oh, I can't do anything now.
No, he's still doing it.
How he did his last gigs, you know. Mm. It was his whole life, wasn't it? And it was quite a brave thing, I think.
I mean, he did a gig up here, didn't he? I think in Islington it was, where he just did it. He sat in the dressing room for the whole show.
But he did the gig, didn't he?
Yeah.
That's the thing.
Yeah.
I mean, against
probably great for photos. he once did. I hadn't seen them for years. I went to Hacienda to see them, and he the whole gig with his back to the audience.
Oh, I was at that.
Yeah. Sure. And he said to me at the end, he said, "Made your job hard tonight, didn't I, Cocker?"
He didn't make yours easy either,
didn't
he?
That was the first gig without
Craig,
wasn't it?
Yeah.
Is that the one you're talking about?
Yeah. No, I wasn't talking about being in the band. I was talking about the one where he only sang about a third of the gig and different bit. One song was sung from the bloody sound booth.
Yeah.
Do you remember that? We blocked that out.
No, that's the gig I'm saying. The first gig without Craig.
Oh, without Craig. Yeah, right. Yeah, I think it was. Yes, that's right. Yeah.
But he was. He kind of just did these things willfully, thinking it was funny.
Yeah, yeah.
Well,
it was.
And it was like when we were talking earlier about the pictures of him and Elaney. I was doing some close-ups, and Elaney said to me, she said, "Kevin, what is the point of having great legs if you're going to take pictures that close up?"
You're talking about Mark? Did you like photographing in the Hacienda?
It was a challenge.
Yeah, I was going to say, I can imagine.
It was all right when there was no one in there.
Yeah.
But when there were people in there, you couldn't take pictures. It was so difficult to work from in there, yeah.
Yeah, another example of why it was a bad bit of engineering.
It was never designed as a venue, but the stage was too small. It was only, you know, if you were anyone 6'6", their head would have been touching the ceiling of that stage.
Yeah, yeah.
It's terrible.
I know. I got wedged one. But I mean, the sound was terrible.
Yeah.
The bar was where the stage should be, and the stage was where the bar should be. But it looked great when it was. If you took a picture of somebody when it was empty.
Yeah, that's right. I know. I used to use it as. If I was photographing a band, I used to use the Hacienda as my studio quite a lot of the time, because it was down the road from my own place. But they had all the lighting rigged up all the time, and I'd sometimes do. You know, I shot the birthday party there, and I shot this band Jazz Defectors and various other people. I had a bit more space to work in, so we used to use it in the afternoon when no one was you know.
And it was always open as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Monday night with like three people.
Yeah.
Friday
night with three people.
Yeah,
as well.
Yeah.
And until they discovered Acid House. Tony Wilson always used to talk about the Hacienda and how, and he'd have all these great theories about why people had started coming and why it had changed and stuff, and Mike Pickering would say, "No, that's all rubbish, Tony." He said, "It's when we started selling Stella for a quid." That's when people started coming.
Plus, you could always get in because it was the big.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it was quite difficult to get in the clubs in that sort of thing. So everybody always seemed to end up at the Hacienda because it was vast, wasn't it? It was too big, really.
Yeah. Yeah, but it was empty for the first 2 years.
Yeah. You there the opening night when Bernard Manning was on?
Yeah, terrible, wasn't it?
Well, I don't know, he could have said the most offensive things about everyone in the room, but you couldn't make out a word he said.
Yeah, Tony thought it'd be hilarious opening a club in Manchester and having Bernard Manning on as his opening act.
Yeah. He refused his fee, didn't he?
Everybody thinks Tony got everything right, but you know, sometimes he made a real rick, didn't he?
Yeah. I've played some shitholes in my time. Yeah. He refused his fee. Yeah. Bernard Manning. I don't want paying for this shit.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's astonishing to look at those photographs of the fall, and not even if you just look at the background, certainly them ones of the G-Man, how Manchester has changed. Because we did that Loud of the Words thing, and where the picture of Mark in front of that gas canister, or whatever they're called, that's where that is now.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
That hotel is,
yeah.
That's how little was going on in Manchester. You could have built one of them gas
reservoirs
right in the middle of the city. It's a massive thing. Because there was just nothing there, was there?
No, I kind of think it was interesting. It's always interesting when you photograph people in urban settings like that, I think, because cities change so rapidly that maybe at the time, you know, the magazine would say, well, you know, that where's the interest there? It's like, I've got a picture of Bernard Sumner walking down the street in New York at 6 a.m. But the cars in the shop help to date it, and 10 years on, those pictures start to look completely different.
Yeah.
And it's really important, I think, sometimes when a band are from a major city like that to include the city in it, because you get some sense of how they grew up and how they developed, and also how they sounded, why they sounded like they did. Because I don't think The Fall or Joy Division, another, maybe a couple of other Manchester bands would have sounded like they did without living in that kind of urban set. It's like the picture of Joy Division on the bridge in the snow. Kind of, I always felt it was my responsibility to let people know what a band sounded like, because obviously then, you know, unless you went out and bought a record or listened to John Peel and there was a record available, unless you went to the gig, you had no idea what they were like.
No.
But if you saw that picture, you'd have an idea what Joy Division sounded like. And I think that was quite important. And I always say, you know, I said, it's got so much space in it, it's so bleak. And Bernard says, well, there's no space in our music. I said, but there actually is.
There is, yeah.
I said, don't even understand your own music.
Well, my mom, Martin Alec gave them a lot of
Yeah, they weren't like that live.
They were kind of a bit like a heavy metal band when they started.
Yeah, I mean, I think Martin Hannett saved them from being Bon Jovi. I think Hooky would have loved to have been in Bon Jovi.
Yeah, well, I think, well, maybe more. I think he'd probably say MC5 rather than.
I think, he might say that, but.
Well, Revenge were fairly heavy metal, weren't they? He had the air for it then as well, didn't he?
Yeah.
They were alright. They were
alright.
A bit goth.
Monaco.
Yeah. Monaco were alright as well.
Monaco weren't as good as Electronic.
No, probably not.
I always thought all the offshoot bands that they did were quite good, but they missed. You know, it's like Electronic were really good, but would have probably been improved by Hooky's bass. And Revenge were quite good, but would have been improved with Bernard's voice.
Yeah.
And so they kind of.
Why bother?
Exactly. So stop doing all these offshoot things. The other two. You know, The other two would have been alright with the other two.
So they like they've just finished the world's biggest world tour, 15 number ones, and everybody's sick to death of Duran Duran. So they split in half and have then the two bleeding bands. We don't want to hear them, you know.
No, it's not
I'm sure a lot of that was it was a more pleasant experience working without each other for a bit.
It was all right. I kind of like the conflict sometimes.
It's massive,
And they were travelling separately. It's like loads of bands do it anyway, you know. I went on tour with the Cult and Billy Duffy said, which bus do you want to go on? And he said, ours is the rock and roll bus and his is the Pipe and Slippers bus.
I'll have the Pipe and Slippers bus.
So they all do it, and Hooky and Bernard were travelling separately, and I'd say to him, why aren't you travelling in the bus with the others? And he'd say, I don't want to catch cancer. So they all smoked.
Ah, right, okay, yeah.
So he had a limo. He had a stretch limo, and they were in a minibus.
I mean, we used to be in the back of a transit with there'd be Mark and Kate and the driver all lighting up bloody Marlboros. And it's not a big back of a van.
No.
I'm sure, you know, it can't have been the healthiest of environments, was it? Well, I mean, other than the fact that we were sitting on cushions on top of the amps, if we'd have had a bit anything, we'd have all been dead.
It wasn't an issue then.
People piled
into the back of the transit to go to gigs halfway around the country. With no safety at all. You're sitting on the equipment.
We did a tour in Germany with the band had two benches, one side, and that was it.
But that sounds like the kind of Mark would always do that.
Yeah.
When he played that, what was the place he played in Croydon? The comedy. was it called Comedy Club or something?
Yeah,
Cartoon Club. He had the band staying in a guest house in Croydon, two to a room at £22 a night for the room. And he and Elaine were staying in the Hilton at Gatwick.
Nice. Damn it.
Yeah.
Well, one time we did a tour of, I think I was in a transit van, and we broke down on the Friday in this place called Holzkirch. It was a sort of twin with itself, really, tiny little German village. And we had no money, and we were there, it was a bank holiday on the Monday, so we were there 3 days, and we had literally £2 each a day.
Did he not give you that PDs?
Well, we didn't get any PDs, we worked out we could get a beer, if we go up for breakfast, we could then sneak a bit of bread and ham, and that'd be your lunch, and then we had enough for one beer and a bowl of soup in the evening. So we did that for 3 days, and we found out on the fourth day, Mark had a bloody credit card, he was going to the next village in the bridge, in a taxi, and eating out every night.
You thought he was sitting in his room?
Oh, we thought he was doing the same. Sorry. Yeah, yeah. There's not a lot to do in Holzkirch, on a Sunday. I must have seen that war memorial 15 times. And I think at this point we're going to open up to the floor for questions, yeah. I think. If that's all right with you, Kevin?
Yeah.
Where's our roving reporter? Anybody got a question? There we are, gentlemen here in the... Children of the Stones. Terrifying. Terrifying TV show, that.
Hello. Question for Kevin, really. The photography that you took, the rock photography, was amazing. Which other of your kind of competitors did you rate of that era? Did you have any? And what was your relationship with them, or did you even mix them at all?
Don't really like music photography. I know I got categorised as that, but I did do other stuff as well. And I wasn't a big fan of music photography. I always thought it was a bit cliched. And I kind of like, when I was studying photography, I studied Diane Arbus and Bill Grant and August Sander. And I kind of like people who didn't photograph musicians, really. So I don't know. I mean, I liked Penny Smith because she was one of the first people I met who gave me a bit of encouragement, really. But most people saw you as trying to take their work from, if they were working for the NME and you came along and they start thinking, I want to do this, I should be doing this, and there'd be a bit of kind of unnecessary rivalry when people could maybe work closer together. So I like certain things. I like certain pictures that people have taken, but I can't say, I don't really know enough about it to comment on it because I didn't really look at a lot of that, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Oh, so Jill Permanowski, you knew her as well, I believe, with kind of contemporaries,
yeah,
as well.
I could tell you a story about a photo of Jill took, but it's probably not very fair.
Tell me when we switch the mic off. Yeah. And I'll add it in without your knowledge. Yeah. Okay. Anybody else?
Kevin, your stories about Mark being late or uncooperative, unhelpful, did you ever complain or get into arguments with him about that?
I never argued with him about anything. I mean, my job is to photograph someone when they're ready. It's kind of up to them, really. And so there's no point in causing any conflict over it. So I never did, no. Much as my friends don't kind of get it, I do have an enormous amount of patience when I'm working with people. And, I could do a great book of hotel lobbies I've sat in waiting for people to turn up.
I was going to ask, is most bands like that? Then?
Yeah. They kind of like Sean Ryder, I photograph Happy Mondays a lot, and Sean Ryder doesn't even know there's 2 10 o'clocks in a day. kind of, you know, I sit there and wait for them to turn up, and when they turn up, I mean, I went to New York once to photograph Duran Duran. It was 5 days before we got the pictures, because we'd have an idea. We were also, they were staying in different hotels, ostensibly for security reasons, but it was because they didn't like each other. So everyone stayed in a different hotel, and we were staying in a really nice hotel, the Royalton in Midtown Manhattan. And we'd meet the manager and say, when are we doing the pictures? And he'd say, well, Simon's not feeling quite up to it today. So we'd say, well, why don't I do a picture of, why don't you just ask him to come down to the lobby of his hotel and I'll photograph him in and around the lobby. He said, great idea, I'll fax him. It's like we all have fucking mobile phones, you know, and he says, I'll fax him. And I said, and PR said, just ring him. And he said, Simon won't do the telephone when he's on tour. He'll get back to us in 24 hours. We said, we're going home tonight.
And he was up the stairs in the same building.
So we had to reconvene in the lobby 24 hours later, and we got a fax from Simon exactly on 24 hours saying, I don't think I want to leave my room.
Oh, Jesus.
So I said, how about if we photograph him in bed? And he said, great idea, I'll fax him.
No.
24 hours late. We're all faxed. We're all sitting in the lobby waiting for the fax. We hear it coming through. No. This went on for 5 days. He's a prick. So
that's excessive. If you ever get them together, then
I took some pictures of them backstage on the second gig with their girlfriends teasing their hair ready to go on stage.
Right. Well, they'd have to be backstage, really, wouldn't they? They can't really avoid that.
No. So we kind of cornered them, really. Got that, and then it just got worse, really. So.
But I mean,
I've been to New York on the wrong weekend to photograph Lloyd Cole once, and he said to me, I went to see him and he said, oh, what are you doing this week? What are you doing out here this weekend? I said, you. He said, I'm not ready for it. He said, I told him that I've been in the studio. He said, I want to get hair cut. I want to get, a bit of sun. He said, can you come back next week? And I said, yeah, okay.
You weren't paying for the flight.
No, and they don't realise they're actually paying for you. It's like when bands pay for you to go on tour and they don't realise. So when you're on tour with them, and they're saying they've got no money and they say, can we have your minibar? And you say, help yourself.
Take as much as you want.
Or go on their bill.
Do you not think that's gone now? Do you not? Bands are a bit more canny now, aren't they?
They are a bit, yeah. But and hotels are a bit.
Bands are a bit as well. I think the idea of where bands are oblivious to what's best for their publicity machine are gone as well, aren't they?
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah, I think so. But that's because everything's digital, and because there isn't as much money on that side as there used to be. I mean, the money was ridiculous on stage, yeah. I could say, oh, I want to go and photograph Morrissey in Japan for the NME, and they'd say, yeah, great, go. You don't want to do an interview. Well, that's all right. I can write captions for the photos. We could do anything,
Yeah.
And we'd just go out for a week and do whatever we wanted.
Bloody nice.
But now you can't.
No, you can't.
No, you've got to get a bloody tube to
Walthamstow.
Selling tote bags at 20 notes a piece.
You were in it at the right time then, weren't you, really?
Oh, I was there. Well, definitely.
You were definitely right.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm here at the right time.
But I mean, bands wasted a lot of money then on it. I always think about
mainly on their music.
Yeah, but look, you talk about someone who's paying some ridiculous amount of hours. So you're paying £300 an hour to play pool in the next room.
Yeah.
Why not play pool for a week and then book the bleeding studio?
Well, they wouldn't realise that. And especially in those residential studios that bands used to go to, they'd get there and they'd think, this is great. They'd spend 2 weeks, like you say, playing pool. and you've got all the technicians and you know your producer, everyone sitting around doing nothing, mm-hmm. and they didn't seem to realise that they were actually paying yeah. for everyone's time while yes. like you say they were playing pool.
Yeah, have you got any experience of that soon?
I have. We did it. Yeah, Cold Selfish. We booked that studio in Glasgow for a month. Snooker table downstairs, having tournaments, and recorded the album and ditched it all. Went in another studio for 3 days and re-recorded the lot.
Really now.
But that's to turn up at a residential studio and you'd say to them, have you got stuff written? Are you going to start rehearsing it? How are you going to do it? And they said, oh no, we think we'll just start writing here once we get the vibe.
Cold Roses 5 years later.
Yeah. Yeah.
Blimey. Anybody else got any other questions before we wrap up? Don't be shy. You'll do it again.
They all come and ask questions when you're signing the book.
Yeah, yeah. This guy here. The handsome guy with the beard, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, we got a look.
Here you go. Question for Paul and Steve. When Briggs joined the band, what difference did that make to Mark, and what difference do you think it made to the Fools Music? You guys were in the band then, weren't you?
Mm. You going first?
No, you can.
Go on.
What difference?
He was nicer for a bit.
He was nicer for a bit.
Yeah.
He was a bit more polite. He was like, can you please turn them monitors up instead of turn the fucking monitors up?
When she first came, she was doing the lights.
Yeah.
And we played the Electric Ballroom. And there's a tape of it. And it's like, can we just have that light down a little bit? Just a little bit, please. And there's one from like 3 months earlier. If you turn that fucking light back on, I'll break your neck, you cunt. So that's what you changed.
Didn't last really, no.
So that was the difference. I don't think that all that about you made him into a pop band. I don't think that's quite true. I think maybe production wise, certainly having your photograph taken took a bit of a.
Well, she also taught in the merits of the domestic refrigerator.
She did, indeed. Yeah, stop putting his milk on a windowsill. Steve was there the first time she went in a chip shop and asked for a scallop, and was disgusted to find it was a potato in batter and not.
Like Peter Mandelson.
Yeah, that's great. Guy, that
I'm a posh
guy. Look him over in the chip shop. Mushy bees, you know. Yes, sir, madam.
Oh yeah, just wondered how much of your old sort of gear you still got. Do you keep it for nostalgia reasons, or do you still use it even? And following on from that, even, can you see...
You mean clothes?
No, camera gear. Equipment, tools of the trade. And can you see photography going full circle on digital, like sort of vinyl is now ahead of CDs? You know, it's gone full loop, basically. Would it ever happen, do you think?
I think digital's great. I mean digital is very democratic, isn't it? You know, if I was photographing a band out in the street, no one would take any notice. You've not got 100 people walking past you trying to take a picture because no one really had a camera. You know, the only time people use their cameras when it was film, you'd take pictures on holiday. You'd finish the film off in the back garden with the dog and send it to the chemist. Whereas now, people take pictures of everything they do. You can't, they're not, you know, everyone's documenting their lives all the time, like a fucking Fassbender or something. You know, when are you ever going to put this film of your life together? I mean, I want to see it. So I don't see people use film, but if I turn up with a roll of film, a magazine, they'll tell me to go home and digitise it. So there's no point unless you're an art photographer and you're doing something like that. If you're working as an editorial photographer, then you try and shoot. It's like people who write in longhand and submit their copy to a newspaper. They just put it through the shredder and tell them to type it up.
Yeah. True. Why wouldn't you?
So I can't see why. I mean, I've still got cameras and stuff, obviously. I use digital, but because you have to. You know, it's like going out shooting on 10x8 plate cameras and insisting that the magazine will get it in a month. That's not kind of how it works, really, unfortunately.
Good question, though. Anybody else?
Paul. I would like to ask Kevin. Obviously, those first shots, you know, you decided to go...
That voice.
You decided to go and... Yeah, hello there.
I recognise that voice.
You decided to go and photograph the band, right? And that was your choice.
Yeah.
And then after that, was it always a commission? Or did you ever at any point say, oh, I'd like to catch up with the Fool again?
It was mainly commission. Occasionally, I'd take some pictures if I was somewhere. But, you know, it's kind of... It's not... If it was as easy as just being able to ring someone and say, oh, I've kind of not photographed you for a year, can I do it? No, you have to earn a living from it as well, and so photographing bands free of charge isn't always that easy to do. And they've got to give you time. I mean, sometimes I'd go and sit in rehearsal rooms with people just to get some up-to-date pictures. But quite often you've got a PR who they're working with, whose job is to stop you doing your job, not to facilitate it. So it's not always that easy.
And you're talking about a difference between going digital. When did you go digital with the Fool?
Where did I what?
Go digital in your photographs for the Fool. What period was that?
2000 or so, okay. Around then.
Was that ahead of the curve or behind the curve, do you think?
Well, I shot a book for Man City in their final season at Main Road in 2002-2003, and I deliberately shot it on film because I wanted, really, it was going to be in colour, I wanted really heavily saturated colours, and I wanted it to be like the kind of colour you get when you're 7 or 8 years old and you live in an inner city and you've never seen a tree or grass before, and you walk into the football stadium for the first time and it's the biggest expanse of green you've ever seen, and that stays with you. And I think that heavily saturated experience, it's like Wizard of Oz when it goes from black and white into colour, it's an absolutely amazing feeling. And I think that's what we wanted to do, and I tried about 20 different film stocks to find a film that would work for that. So I shot that on film that whole season, and all the other photographers were using digital, and some of them had never shot on film, and they were laughing, you know, they were saying, how do you know you've got a picture? And I said, well, because that's kind of my job, and I've kind of shot on film all my life, and so you have that experience. And they didn't get it, they didn't understand it at all, because they were there with their laptops and getting a picture immediately and so on, and I'd get mine back 2 days later. You know, yeah, and that's kind of what it was like. And so, but I did have digital cameras then, it's just that I decided I was going to do a book on film and then leave it. That would probably be the last thing I shot on film.
Anybody else?
Should we draw it there?
One more question.
Well, I'm thinking Kevin
will be
football.
Yeah. It's 2:15. They haven't even announced the teams yet.
No, I'm all right. I'm okay for now. Yeah. So.
Final question.
Okay. It's a kind of question in two parts for Kevin. Firstly,
two
did you
parts.
Ever...
Well, did you have one question?
I'm sorry.
Did you ever consider becoming a sports photographer, knowing your interest in football? And also, you know, do you think there's a difference between being able to enjoy the music as a music photographer, whereas as a sports photographer, you wouldn't probably be able to enjoy the game as much because you're concentrating on
well, you get something different out of it, aren't you? If you're, you know, I wouldn't want to photograph. I wouldn't want to take pictures for Man City all the time. And also, when I was shooting for City, when I did the book for City, it wasn't just a book of action shots. I was photographing the crowd and the environment the ground was in and fans in and outside the ground and stuff like that. Also, I mean, I did photograph players at training and did some pictures during the game because obviously that was the focus of people going there for 2 hours. But I've not been trained to be a sports photographer. It looks really difficult. I'm much better off. And also, you've got to get up really early. It was a really difficult year for me, that. Because they're on the training pitch at 10 o'clock in the morning. And I don't even get into action till about lunchtime. Because normally I'm used to, you know, I've always worked with musicians who kind of turn up, if they're doing a studio session with you, they turn up at 10, 11 o'clock at night. So I'm used to kind of working through the night rather than getting up at 9 to get on a football pitch for 10 o'clock. I can't really do it. I used to enjoy gigs, photographing them live. I'm not a massive fan of taking live photos at gigs, but I used to kind of enjoy it because I was always at the front, so I always felt part of the action. So it was quite exciting. And also, there is a slight level of uncertainty when you shoot on film, because, you know, you're not immediately checking what's on the back of your camera straight away. You know, you're concentrating and trying to time it and get the perfect shot. Whereas I think with digital, it's a bit more throwaway. So I don't know, I mean, I couldn't do sports photography though. It's like doing ballet, it's really difficult. You've got to get it exactly the right moment or else it's shit.
Thank you very much. Well, bombshell. Well, I have to say thank you. If you put your hands together, take them up.
Thank you.
Well, that brings us unbelievably to the end of Series 3 of Old Brother. Thanks for joining us for this series. Hope you enjoyed us with Trinon. Big thanks, of course, to all our amazing guests for agreeing to join us here. We're eternally grateful. If the Gribblers were in, the creek don't rise, we'll be back with a new series pretty soon. In the meantime, don't forget to follow us on Twitter, at Old Brother Show, where you'll find lists to our Spotify playlist. You can also subscribe via iTunes, Stitcher or RSS. Then you'll be all set for Series 4 when it does arrive. You can also give us a rating on iTunes or subscribe on YouTube or just tell your friends if you fancy it too. For further reading, our books The Bid Midweek and Have a Beating Guess are still available from Root Publishers and all good bookshops. And we hope to speak to you all again soon. And remember, if you're driving, take your car. Ta-da.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional unprofessional, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.